gang, welcome back. This is Henrik. Good to have you with us for another Red Ice radio program. This is the counter-establishment radio show that seeks to communicate with you just how volatile and genocidal so-called diversity and multiculturalism really is. Don't believe the hype. They are really just trying to eradicate you and your progeny forever and destroy your civilization. Join the movement against globalization and vote for people's self-determination and their ability to decide over themselves instead of having bloated, gluttonous internationalists telling you how to live and with whom you have to live, as they're forcing incompatible cultures and warring religions together, creating more conflict and violence than ever before, without really explaining why all of this must take place. So our guest today on the program is Adrian Davis. He was born in Somerset, the west of England. He's the eldest son of the traditional Catholic writer and polemicist Michael Davis. He was educated at Cambridge University, London University, and the Sorbonne. Today he's an English barrister or a trial lawyer practicing in chambers in the Temple. He's a railway enthusiast, chess player, student of natural history and human folly, and also a contested South Staffordshire parliamentary constituency for the Freedom Party in 2005. He has represented many thought criminals and political dissidents in the English court as a change from commercial practice. Our topic today is the Brexit aftermath. Stay tuned. Welcome, Adrian. Thank you so much for coming on with us. A pleasure to speak with you today. I hope you had a good weekend.
Yes, thank you very much, Andrew. That's very kind. A pleasure to speak with you.
Excellent. So we know that you're a barrister. You've done, of course, several speeches on nationalist politics in Europe, Western Europe primarily. You're well-versed in how politics relates to culture and art. But what do you think our audience should know about you, Adrian, before we kind of dive into the main issue of Brexit and what this means for Europe overall today?
I don't know that there is much to know about me, so...
That's perfectly fine.
Yeah, yes.
Well, what was your initial thoughts on Brexit, Adrian? I mean, as the results came in and we realized on the 24th about what is going to happen to the UK, what did you think initially?
I voted for the Leave side. I have to tell you, I'm not one of those people who was a gung-ho leaver. I thought about this very carefully. I don't think that the issues were at all clear-cut. But in the end, I decided that it was more important to cast an anti-establishment vote than necessary to think through in minute detail all the consequences of leaving and all the consequences of remaining. I should also tell you quite candidly that I did not expect Leave to win.
Right.
I thought that as we got closer to the referendum date, there would be a swing back to Remain. Just as in the Scottish referendum, there was a swing back to a pro-union position as we got closer to the referendum, or more likely in Scotland, more pro-union people came out of the woodwork and decided to cast their vote, seeing the way it was going. So I was not actually expecting Leave to win, especially not after the murder of the Member of Parliament, Joe Cox, by a deranged individual who had some very, very distant connections with right-wing, fringe right-wing politics, which was undoubtedly being used by many people on the Remain side to try to stigmatise everyone who was opposed to British membership of the European Union as some kind of violent political extremist. So the results came as a surprise to me, I have to say. I had thought that Remain would narrowly prevail.
Yeah.
In fact, the opposite happened. Leave narrowly prevailed. I incidentally knew that Leave had won by about 12:30 on Friday, after the first English results were declared in Newcastle and Sunderland. It became apparent from that very, very early point that Leave was doing much, much better in the more economically depressed and disadvantaged areas than anyone had expected, and that Remain was doing much less well in the prosperous areas than anyone had expected. So it was quite apparent that Remain was underpolling expectations in its strong areas Leave was polling way above its expectations in its strong areas. I didn't sit up all night to listen to results. I had to go to work the next day. So I just concluded by about 12:30 that Leave was going to win and went to bed.
There you go. Yeah. No, but you're right, Adrian. I mean, if we look at the breakdown, if you will, of who voted to Leave, it seems that it was poorer people with less education, basically, if we were to believe how the media broke it down. Basically, I guess the working white classes and also the older white population in England. That seems to be what kind of swayed it in this direction, right?
Well, and in Wales, incidentally. The United Kingdom is made up of four constituent nations: England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And while in Scotland there was a significant majority for Remain, and in Northern Ireland a slightly smaller majority for Remain, the voting patterns between Wales and England were almost indistinguishable. I think England cast 1% more of the vote for Leave than Wales did, but Wales cast a large majority of the votes for Leave. That's a region which benefited very significantly from economic assistance from the European Union. And that largesse, which has been considerable, bought no political support, it would seem.
Yeah, very interesting. I want to ask you more about Scotland later and how this breaks down and everything else. But let's just talk a bit about what this means for England specifically, and what you think is going to happen now next. There's a number of people, of course, that have begun to argue that okay, they might draw out this process. It might take years, of course, for the UK to enter out of the EU. Some people have even speculated that maybe they will cut a different kind of deal with the EU and to a certain extent remain in certain areas, but they're going to change things. What do you think is going to happen next?
It's very, very difficult to say. I think the Leave campaign were themselves surprised to win. What has happened since then is that our Prime Minister has resigned. I am not a great admirer of our Prime Minister, David Cameron, but I will say that his resignation statement was extremely dignified, and he has carried himself with great dignity and has accepted the outcome in a very honourable way that was completely contrary to his wishes and against which he'd campaigned very hard for several months. So all credit to him for that. He deserves it, even though he's not someone who I politically like one little bit. Now, some of the things that have followed on from that have been contrary to the expectations of everybody. For example, a lot of the people who have supported Leave subscribe, as a great many right-wingers and dissidents do, to all kinds of conspiracy theories. And one of the conspiracy theories or paranoid theories was, oh, well, somehow the elite will find a way of undoing this referendum result. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think one of the things that may have surprised perhaps the Leavers has been the vehemence with which Mr. Juncker has demanded that if we're leaving, we should jolly well get on with it and leave as soon as possible. We're now in the extraordinary position that the most prominent advocates of Leave in England are trying to put off the day when they give the, if I put it this way, the departure notice, the notice under Article 50 of the treaties, under which the European Union is organised, giving notice of intention to leave. Whereas the president of the European Commission is telling us to give it tomorrow, if we'd be so kind, and not mess everybody around by dilly-dallying. So paradoxically, it's now the European Union that wants us to go more almost than we appear to wish to go ourselves.
That's interesting. Yeah,
It's at first, it's counterintuitive. And in some respects, even upon further reflection, remains counterintuitive. The United Kingdom is a major contributor to the European Union budget. I believe that after Germany, it is the second biggest contributor.
Right. Yeah.
Losing these very substantial contributions will have a serious effect on the European Community's budget, and not a good one. So it is, in a sense, surprising that they are so quick to call for the departure of one of the principal contributors. But I think that, in a way, they're wise. They understand that this decision is about politics, not economics. And they also understand that it is important to consolidate the remaining nations of the European Union before anybody else starts getting any similar ideas. I don't think that the powers that be in Brussels and Strasbourg are going to be able to put this genie back in the bottle very easily. There are obviously other countries in Europe which are not happy with their relationship with the European Union. And having seen this example, they're likely to consider referendums of their own. But I can perfectly well also see why Herr Juncker is anxious to, to speed up the process of getting rid of this awkward and difficult member of the club before our attitude infects other members.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think it was Martin Schulz that mentioned basically that there has to be some consequence with this. It seems like for them to try to avoid a chain reaction of other nations, which seems to be the case now. We can discuss that more in detail later. But
yes,
he expressed this desire to basically, some consequences has to be put on the Britons, he said, so that we can prevent this, basically. So it's going to be very interesting to see in what way they're trying to punish you on your way out, if you will.
Well, I'll also be interested to see what punishments they imagine that they can inflict. The United Kingdom has many problems of its own, which have nothing to do with our membership of the European Union. And I'll talk about those perhaps in a while. And one of the consequences of this referendum is that those in England who have been fond of blaming the European Union for all our woes will no longer be able to use it as a scapegoat for every ill from which the nation suffers. But one of the problems from which our country suffers is it is in a chronic and serious trading deficit with the rest of the world. In the region, it's leading to 5 to 6% of GDP, which is extremely serious and not sustainable in the long term. In other words, we import significantly more than we export every year. And this has been going on for a while. Now, one of the countries which runs a huge trade surplus with England is Germany. It is difficult to see how the European Union could impose tariffs upon any British imports into the remaining countries of the European Union or otherwise seek to punish us for leaving without inviting retaliatory tariffs that will do a great deal more harm to the German economy than the European Union is capable of doing to ours. So that would not seem to be a terribly feasible option. It will be interesting to see what happens. That's all I can say.
Yeah, definitely. Well, some of the other consequences so far, of course, is I think UK was stripped now of its AAA rating, and the FTSE, the FTSE, have been losing and everything else. Has this continued to plummet the pound in the last few days? I've actually haven't been keeping up with it, but basically just within minutes of the initial results coming in from Sunderland, I believe there was a massive drop in the pound. Has this continued?
It stabilized a little today. I don't think that short-term currency fluctuations are actually terribly important.
Right.
There are long-term pressures on the pound, which have got nothing to do with our membership of the European Union. They are principally the chronic trade deficit that I just mentioned, and the inability of the British government to raise sufficient money through taxes to cover its expenditure, which is another kind of deficit, is also very serious. And these things lead to a high level of borrowing by the British state, although it's not so bad for some continental European countries. And they will tend to put downward pressure on the currency because it needs to be funded by borrowing from abroad. And it gives the impression of an economy that is not in such good order as our rulers would like you to believe it is. So I don't think the downward pressure on the pound is necessarily caused entirely by the decision to leave the European Union, although obviously that has precipitated an immediate short-term crisis, caused essentially by the fact that financial markets don't like political instability, and undoubtedly one of the inevitable consequences of the decision to leave the European Union will be a measure of political instability for the foreseeable future. As I say, for the moment, we have a prime minister who has announced his intention to resign as soon as a successor to the leadership of the Conservative Party is chosen through the party's own internal mechanisms. While that is unlikely to take a very long time, it will take a few weeks. And while that goes on, there will obviously be some turmoil. There's also a bigger picture of no one knows what the future of the United Kingdom outside, how the future United Kingdom outside the Union, European Union will play out. So it doesn't surprise me. Everyone had predicted a fall in sterling if we left the European Union. It has happened. It has not been so calamitous as we were told it would be, but it would not be at all surprising to see further falls in the currency. The FTSE is a strange thing. Unlike many continental countries, the upper echelons of the FTSE, the so-called FTSE 100 companies, 100 most important companies listed on the London Stock Exchange, are really global companies. Many of them are affected by factors that have little to do with what goes on in the European Union. For example, many of them are gigantic commodities producers. Now, they have been adversely affected by a lack of demand for the commodities that they produce. And that has nothing to do with developments in the European Union. If the Chinese are buying less iron ore or less copper, and if the world price of oil has collapsed, so that huge companies such as British Petroleum, which is listed on the London Stock Exchange, or Shell, which is listed both in London and in Amsterdam, suffer substantial drops in the value of their principal product. These things will tend to have a depressing effect on the stock exchange. They have little to do with membership of the European Union. Now, that said, the next tier of companies, many of which have extensive trade with Europe, will be affected, and they will also be affected psychologically, if I can put it that way, by uncertainty. Most of the managers of these companies were strong supporters of Remain and will be shell-shocked to see how comprehensively the people have rejected their recommendations.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, when Cameron did his resignation speech, he mentioned his dream, if you will, of sort, or his belief in the fact that the United Kingdom could be a multi-ethnic and a multi-faith society. He said that he loved the country and all these things, but I think he, together with Tony Blair, who really, you know, opened the floodgates. There was a book released just a couple of months ago that was exposing Tony Blair's basically own desires to change the face of Britain, basically, with immigration, right? I mean, he changed millions of statuses on immigrants into economic migrants and things like this in order for this process to change. And I think David Cameron has very much kept this up. But my question for you is, when he says that he loves the country, is he talking about the government structure, the values which the United Kingdom today represents? Because it certainly seems that these recent leaders in the UK, they don't love their people, right? They've done everything they can to displace them and to cause further unemployment and economic issues and all this. How do you see the immigration debate in relation to what's happening here lately?
The immigration, the relationship between the immigration debate and British membership of the European Union is a very, very strange and complex issue. There is no doubt that in the minds of the people, certainly of that 52% of the people who voted to leave, the referendum was, for a great many of them, particularly the less well-off, an expression of their general discontent of the direction in which British society has travelled in the last 30 years. That involves a number of factors, but not a very large number, and they are to some extent interconnected. Immigration is certainly one of the most important, and perhaps the most important. When Tony Blair came to power in 1997, England in particular, the United Kingdom in general, had a problem with badly integrated or, frankly, wholly unintegrated minorities. And each minority needs to be considered by its own terms of reference. They're not all the same. There are many different groups in the United Kingdom. Some are better, some are worse integrated into the society in which they live. Some are more troublesome, some less so, some prosperous, some poor and a constant burden upon public funds. Because the United Kingdom has experienced immigration from such a vast number of countries, of such different peoples, its experience is quite, if you like, it's not uniform across the country, and it's not uniform according to the area of the country, because some have received immigrants from, say, Afro-Caribbean societies, who on one level are, well, I have, I'll be careful what I say here, let me put it this way, there is an association in the public mind between high levels of Afro-Caribbean immigration and particular kinds of crime stroke antisocial behaviour that you would not get with, say, immigration from parts of the Indian subcontinent, where the immigrants tend to be law-abiding and much more prosperous. Then again, communities from the Afro-Caribbean world are Christian communities. They are not, generally speaking, there have been some who have converted to radical Islam, become very violent, but they're a tiny minority of people. They're not generally filled with enthusiasm for jihad against the British state, unlike a minority, but nevertheless a sizable minority of young alienated Muslims, particularly young alienated Muslim men. So each community presents different problems for the majority society. Nevertheless, the feature of the Blair government was that while in 1997 there were a large number of such communities, particularly in our urban areas, they did not represent an enormous percentage of the total population of the United Kingdom, nor were they growing especially fast relative to the majority population. So the situation had stabilised. A great many of the indigenous people didn't like what happened, but they had more or less accepted it in the sense that these areas had had large populations, not of British or European origin, for a couple of generations by 1997, certainly for 50 years in some places, and for 40 years or whatever in many of them. People were used to it. What then happened under Blair was that he more or less opened the borders and let the world in. Millions came, and that had wholly predictable consequences. If you greatly increase the labour force, then wages drop sharply. That was one consequence. That pleased his friends in big business, the exploitative employers of cheap labour, who can then reduce wages for both indigenous people and immigrants alike.
Right.
Another consequence is that great strain is placed upon social housing. England is an overpopulated country. It is especially overpopulated in its southeastern corner, which is where most of the new immigrants have come. They don't want to live in other parts of the country because those regions are much less economically active, successful, and so on than London and the South East. And therefore, London and the South East are a magnet for ambitious people from all over the world who all imagine the streets of London are paved with gold and they will all make their fortunes here and be great successes and so on. Many of them, of course, end up living four to a room, working for pitiful wages and paying landlords, grasping landlords, often from their own ethnic community, exorbitant rents to live in squalor. And the dream turns out to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
But that doesn't stop more coming every year, believing that for them it will be different. They'll be the ones who get the lucky break and so on. And of course, people in their countries of ethnic origin hear about the ones who are successful, who have made the big money, who've got the lovely house and the fast car and success in business and so on. They don't hear that for every one of those, there are 99 who end up working in a badly paid service economy for poor wages and living in difficult economic circumstances, resented by many of the indigenous population, and generally living a not very happy life. But that wasn't something that Blair told the wool about, shall we say. But the influx of the Blair was enormous. It was transformative. Yeah, yeah. It's brought about a situation now where within two generations, it is conceivable that the indigenous population of these islands could be reduced to an ethnic minority in their own country. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility. The consequences have been absolutely, totally, predictably catastrophic. Wages have been driven down. housing has become hideously expensive, social services under tremendous strain, public transport is under tremendous strain, the cost of housing has been driven up to frightening levels, such as most people in London can now never hope to own their own home, etc., etc., etc. The elite didn't care about this because they benefited from a service economy in which poorly paid immigrants would do jobs, effectively servant-type jobs. And this is the irony. Blair presides over a party that claims to be a socialist party. His government recreated a society with the social structures of Victorian England, in which the middle classes had servants who waited on them hand and foot for pitiful wages and were glad to get those. Well, that is the society which he has recreated.
Let me ask you, though, when David Cameron says something like that, that he has a desire, a dream, or an aspiration for the country to be multi-ethnic and multi-faith, that, that Christianity will have to be next to Islam and Hinduism and all these things, do you know why this desire is there in our Western leadership? Why do they have a need to create something which is no longer exclusively English or Swedish or German or French, etc.? Huge problem in Europe right now. What drives them to do this, do you think?
Well, it's beyond my comprehension. It really is. I can understand the mentality. It's a very unattractive mentality, but I can understand the mentality of the capitalist employer of labour who desires only to have more and more cheap labour, always to drive wages down, always to make the condition of his workforce more precarious so that they ask for fewer rights, lower wages and accept worse working conditions. I can't understand the mentality of someone who persuades himself that it's somehow a good thing to transform a stable, homogenous society with a shared culture, shared origins, shared identity, shared history, into a fractured, polyglot, mutually antagonistic mosaic of different cultures, religions, and ethnicities who have nothing in common but a piece of paper which tells them that they're a citizen of a particular state, and shared shopping habits, which about is sums up modern England. The mentality of someone who actually thinks that this is a good thing, rather than that they might personally financially benefit from this transformation of society, is beyond my comprehension. Even more so than that of a Marxist, for example. Even more so, the kind of person who thinks it is a good thing to destroy a historic nation and replace it with the chaos that now prevails in much of urban Europe, not just England, is, to my mind, mentally and spiritually ill. I mean, I always say that liberalism is a form of spiritual syphilis or AIDS, and those who are infected with it in a high degree, Angela Merkel is an extreme example. You just wonder whether they can be cured at all. I doubt it myself. I think they're just mentally and spiritually sick to such a level that really all you can do with them is exclude them from any position of influence in society, and one hopes in due course confine them to psychiatric institutions where perhaps people can see whether electroconvulsive therapy helps. I don't know. It might work. Yeah. Those of you who've read George Orwell's 1984, it's a marvellous book. I could never help liking the sinister inner party comrade O'Brien. He had some ideas, of course, for curing people, which were quite interesting. And I think it would be interesting to work on Blair or Angela Merkel in room 101 and see whether it was possible to cure them. I don't know. It was a very interesting experiment. I hope one day we should be in a position to carry it out.
All right. Well, absolutely. I mean, there's something going on here. Now, some have pointed out the fact that the lower classes of non-ethnic, European non-ethnic people or non-native population that's coming into Europe serves as a new kind of proletariat, right? That there's the class struggle has now become transmuted into kind of a racial struggle almost, right? That the new perpetual proletariat is going to be the non-white population of Europe. And so this is the way that they've continued their kind of Marxist restructuring of society. Would you agree that that's a possibility, or do we have another explanation here?
I have to say that Much though I loathe the Marxist left, I actually blame them for this situation far less than the capitalist right. It is not the Marxist left that has transformed Europe. It is existing financial and economic elites. Undoubtedly in England, I wouldn't presume to comment upon other countries, I'm not sure that I know enough about them, but undoubtedly in England, the factor driving mass immigration all the way back to the 1950s has been the desire of employers to drive down wages by increasing the supply of labour. It really is as simple as that.
Right.
Now, latterly, I would agree that there has been an element which has seen the transformation of our societies in a way contrary to the interests of the indigenous people as benefiting either their ideological position or, in some cases, their religious position, and in yet other cases, their ethno-religious position. I'll not define that any more clearly, but I think a number of your listeners will understand what I mean.
Right.
Yeah. But all these groups have, of course, different reasons for desiring what has happened. Nevertheless, I do not agree with some of the conspiracy theorists who you get in right-wing circles who believe that the whole process can be explained by some kind of ethnic-based conspiracy theory. I think that's absolute nonsense.
Okay.
It's clear that the imperative behind this process, in its origins and certainly even now, is economic.
Okay, and so obviously that drives down, as you say, the wages of the of the workers, etc. But ultimately, in the long run, this is okay. Granted, I understand that they don't think long term. Many of these companies they think about the short term profits. We have the boards, we have all the people, the directors of these companies. They need to show immediate profit. But in the long run, obviously, by putting such a huge drain on European and Western economies that now is happening, who's going to buy all their products? Who's going to buy all their stuff at the end of it? If our economies are tanking as a consequence of this wave of migrants that we're seeing into our countries?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the wave of migrants has up to now caused the economies to tank. It may now be beginning to do so. The penny's beginning to drop with people that wages per capita are falling. One of the lies that is a half-truth which the proponents of mass immigration have advanced, is that it increases gross domestic product. I have two answers to that. The first is that those who remember the story of Esau in the Bible will remember that he sold his birthright for what was rather picturesquely called a mess of pottage, a kind of stew in a pot. And he was not the richer for the exchange. I would rather live in a country that was slightly, perhaps poorer, but was more recognisably British and European. But the second is that in any event, what matters is not gross domestic product, but gross domestic product per capita. And it is finally beginning to dawn upon people that that is actually falling and will continue to fall. And it is not surprising. If you bring large numbers of people with few skills who add little value to carry out, bluntly, the lowest kind of work that exists in society, the worst paid, the most unpleasant kind of manual and other work, you depress average earnings. You may increase the overall size of the economy. Of course you will. If you bring 20 million people to a country with a population of 20 million, you will significantly increase its gross domestic product. It will, of course, no longer be the same country, and its GDP per capita may very well fall, but its overall GDP will rise. Now, all that sounds a little bit technical, but the basic drift that it doesn't matter, that what doesn't matter to the ordinary man or woman, whether the total
size of his or her country's economy increases. What matters to him or her is the wages that the man or woman in the street can reasonably expect to draw at the end of a week's work, and that is falling as a result of immigration. And this can be seen to an extreme level in the United States, which has less labor protection than European countries, so the phenomenon is now more advanced. Never has there been a greater disparity between the top 1% and the rest of American society.
Right.
Never have profits been so great, and never have average wages been so low in relation to the profits that those corporations are making. So in the short term, and even in the short to medium term, it's working out very well for these corporations. But secondly, that there's another point. They are not monopolists. They're all in competition with one another. Unless the state exercises its sovereign authority to say that businessmen will not be allowed to put their own interests ahead of those of the nation, no individual business can afford to do so. You cannot compete with a competitor who is prepared to be more ruthless than you are by employing poorly paid immigrant labor. You can't compete with them successfully. You can't compete with them on a level playing field if you yourself are going to tend to be ethical, only employ indigenous labor and pay them decent wages. Inevitably, you will fail, or at any rate, they will be making much bigger profits than you are. And if you are a publicly quoted company, your shareholders will not be very happy.
Right. So it's really the structure of the economic system that has generated a lot of this that we're seeing today. Well,
it's not so much that. I'm a believer in the free market system, but I believe it has to be regulated by the state in the broader interests of the community.
Right.
Yeah. For example, it might suit a factory owner to discharge untreated chemical waste into the water supply, but plainly you can't allow that to happen because
right.
people die.
Yeah.
All regulations relating to health and safety in factories, the not employing child labor, to providing safe systems of work and so on, these are all regulations imposed by the state for the greater good of the community. And it's also for the benefit of honest and decent capitalists that this should be done, because otherwise, if they themselves import these improvements unilaterally, so to speak, they'll be suffering a competitive disadvantage. If one man voluntarily decides, he doesn't want to employ children in his factory because really that's not right, they ought to be at school, and he's going to pay higher wages because he doesn't think people should be left wondering where the next meal is going to come from, and his competitor doesn't think so, you can see which one's going to fail in business, can't you? The state has to make sure that unethical practices of this kind and socially unacceptable practices of this kind are stamped out. One of the extraordinary things about modern England and modern Europe generally is the stupidity of the leaders of the trade unions, the labour unions, who seem to be quite unable to grasp that an increase in supply of labour inevitably drives down wages. But as I say, the situation, which I think is very much driving the Trump phenomenon in the US, that people have now realised that tiny, tiny elites, I don't even think it's fair to say the top 1%, I actually think it's smaller than that, and quite significantly smaller, have taken well over 90% of the benefit from any increase in economic activity over the last 20, 25 years. That is finally, ordinary people have finally grasped that, and they are very, very angry. And of course, one of the ways they've demonstrated this anger, to bring us back to the beginning of this discussion, is by completely discounting the advice of those financial and commercial elites in this referendum, because they know that the advice is given for self-serving purposes by men and women who have no interest in the welfare of the community as a whole, only in their profit margins.
Right, so you're talking about the laissez-faire, the thinking that money is smarter than people, and let it just kind of take its course and it will work out in our favor or something, right?
Yes.
All right. So many things, of course, we could comment in relation to this, but let's go back a bit to the UK here and the situation there now then. Will Britain be able to take control over its borders again now with an exit out of the European Union? What do you think is going to happen when it comes to things like immigration and a sense of national pride again for Great Britain?
Well, this is a very interesting question. The first thing I would say is that the larger part of immigration into the United Kingdom does not come from the European Union and never has We could regulate it now, but we don't, because our political class don't want to. It is very noticeable that some of the principal supporters of the Leave campaign, who are neoliberals in their economic outlook, are saying that they will not use their victory to reduce overall immigration into the United Kingdom. That certainly includes the likes of Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, who are neoliberals in the American sense of the word. It includes David Hannum, one of the leading conservative members of the European Parliament, who was a successful campaigner on the Leave side. It even includes, though with much greater ambiguity, Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage is a much more interesting character. I'm not sure that Nigel really knows what Nigel thinks. He seems to think different things at different times. At one moment, he is himself saying that, oh, well, one of the marvellous things about leaving the European Union is that we'll be able to exclude all these ghastly Poles, Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, and so we'll be able to invite lots of marvellous people, such as Nigerians, Somalis, and Bengalis to our country instead. Yes, that sounds like an improvement to me. You may detect a slight note of sarcasm there, but right. You get the general. That's what he says in one mood. In another mood, he'll say, oh, it's awful travelling on the suburban railways around London. You need to go from London Bridge to Grove Park, which is about 8 or 9 miles south, before you first begin to hear people speaking English in the carriage. Now, which of those is the real Nigel? I don't know. I'm not sure that even he knows, actually.
Right. Okay.
One of the most interesting things that will now happen is that the United Kingdom Independence Party is going to have to decide what kind of party it is. If it really is a party about no more than leaving the European Union, then once the process is completed, which will take a couple of years because we need to disentangle ourselves from quite complex legal and commercial relationships and set up new legal and commercial relationships with the member states of the European Union and indeed the European Union itself. But the process will be completed in a couple of years. Article 50 contemplates that. Whether the United Kingdom Independence Party will any longer serve any purpose, because it will, after all, have achieved its objective, one possibility is that it will simply fade away and that its voters will drift off to other parties or back to the parties from which they came. Another is that it will undergo quite an exciting process of radicalization, the model of which I'm thinking is Alternative für Deutschland, which was in its origins a neoliberal Eurosceptic party, but has become transformed into a populist nationalist party of a very successful kind, the first effectively successful nationalist party in Germany since 1945, particularly successful because it's not based upon attempts to rehabilitate the former regime, which isn't capable of being rehabilitated. So it's the first party really to have broken with the Nazi past, yet is a radical populist rightist party. Now, British political parties don't suffer from the kind of problems that people do in Germany, the difficulty of the country's history. And it would arguably be much easier for UKIP to undergo that process than it was for AFD. And since AFD has undergone it successfully, there's absolutely no reason why UKIP shouldn't, and in a short period of time. That is one of the most interesting questions over the next couple of years in British politics.
Yeah, you know, later in the second segment here, I want to ask you more about the state of the parties in the UK, and if UKIP is it in terms of you know, some kind of populist nationalist parties, or if there's others. But you know, before we take a break in a little bit, and kind of going on from that point, I guess you sent us a link to the British Democrats, right? Are you involved with them? Tell us about them.
Yeah, I mean, I British Democrats are a small party. I think it'd be fair to say, I say that's one of the people who was involved in setting it up, that we think we have the right program, and we think we have some good people, and we think we've set up structures within the party that will involve some of the but rather will avoid some of the difficulties that such parties have suffered from in the past, having one excessively dominant individual who becomes corrupt, tyrannical, etc., mismanages the party and runs it into catastrophe. You probably guess who I'm thinking of. But on the other hand, it would also be fair to say that we have not been trampled to death in the rush of people who are anxious to join such a party. One of the problems that faces the if you like, extra-parliamentary British right, people outside the system parties, is the emergence of UKIP. If we were having this conversation 10 years ago, everybody had been very excited about the British National Party, which at that time appeared to be going places, doing great things. It was winning large numbers of council seats, become the official opposition on a couple of councils. It had really broken the taboo against so-called racist parties being elected even to municipal office in England. Then, of course, it went on to win a couple of seats in the European Parliament. Then, for various reasons, it went into a decline and has now collapsed to such a point at which it scarcely exists, except as a handful of people who hang on to the name and the legal rights of the party for the purpose of soliciting donations, usually legacies in the wills of elderly supporters. It's not, for practical purposes, a functioning political party anymore. But the difficulty is that for tens of thousands of people who in the first decade of the new millennium passed through that party, its membership peaked about 12,000, but its turnover was enormously high. So the total number of people who have passed through the ranks of the party in a decade would, I'm guessing, be in the region of 70 or 80,000, because in many years it would turn over 75% of its members. So its membership might be 10,000 on the 1st of January and 10,000 on the 31st of December, but there'd be a different 10,000, if you see what I mean, or or 7 or 8,000 of them would be different people. So I say of the tens of thousands of people who passed through the ranks of that party in the first decade of the new millennium, a few have shown any desire to be engaged in another similar party, even, frankly, a much better run party, without any of the financial corruption or other scandals that affected the BNP. The sad fact is that a great many people were disillusioned by that experience and will not easily be brought back into politics. The second consequence has been that UKIP has effectively occupied the electoral space that such a party would desire to occupy. So it is very, very difficult to get anything better, if I may put it, than UKIP in ideological terms, more ideologically coherent, less muddled, less conservative, to use the American phrase. It is difficult to get anything like that off the ground with any degree of success, because people will tend to respond that UKIP is doing the job already, and even people with a background of involvement in right-wing parties will tend to say that while we may have created a better party, it is not going to be possible to organise mass electoral support for such a party for so long as UKIP bestrides the scene like a colossus. Now, as I say, the interesting question going forward is going to be what will happen to UKIP. Will it transform itself into a populist nationalist party? Or will it fade away? I don't see a third course for UKIP. I don't see there is any other possibility but the one or the other, the becoming what its supporters imagine that it is and want it to be, but it isn't in truth at the moment, or the fading away. I don't see that it can carry on as it is now, because it is not possible for a single issue party that has achieved its single issue, if you see what I mean.
Of course.
Carry on. Yeah. I mean, you can't keep on saying that the most important issue in British politics is leaving the European Union if we've left.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And there will be no possibility of rejoining. That's another thing. Once you are out of that club, the process of rejoining is so hideously complex and the terms that would be on offer so very unfavourable that I don't think it would ever happen. One of the cautionary notes for Eurosceptics before this referendum was the suggestion that in many ways the United Kingdom had actually achieved quite a good deal from the European Union. We were not in Schengen, we were not committed to ever closer union, and above all, we were not in the euro, which is an instrument of torture for the nations of Southern Europe and their peoples, upon whom it has inflicted the most horrific hardship for 10 years now, and will continue to do so until the currency eventually shatters, which I'm sure it will.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk more about this after a short break here, but Let me just give out a few websites here. Then the BritishDemocraticParty.co.uk is where people can go if they want to take a closer look at the British Democrats. I also think you had Standard Bearer Books. Was that set up with Jonathan Bowden, by the way?
Yes. Standard Bearers is a book to which Jonathan Bowden, myself, and many other authors on the British right have contributed. It was published by the Bloomsbury Forum, which I was one of the animators, as was Jonathan. A number of us got together to write this book a few years ago now. And it's had an influence, I think, on people on the British right. It's an interesting book because it exposes people to ideas which are not within the mainstream of modern British political thought, but were articulated by men who were, in their day, often very powerful and influential figures. So what it shows, I think it shows something very interesting, that since 1945, the political discourse in England has grown ever narrower and ever more tightly confined in a straitjacket of, on the one hand, social democracy on the left, on the other hand, liberal finance capitalism as a pseudo-right. And nothing more radical than either of those options has been permitted to raise its voice in the agora, if I can put it that way. Well, that was not so in England before 1939, let alone before 1914, when far more interesting ideas were far more widely discussed. And the purpose of the book was to introduce people to the ideas of some of these thinkers of a former era that are still very relevant for today, and very instructive in showing that British political thought has not always been trapped in this narrow paradigm that has been the boundaries of permitted political discourse in England for the last 70 years.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a Standard Bearers Book Facebook page that we'll add a link to. Is there any other links, Adrian, you'd like to give out here before we take a short break?
Probably not. I mean, those are the two I'd particularly draw to people's attention.
All right, very good. You sent us a couple of Twitter accounts too. I guess we can add a link to that.
Yes, please add the links to those by all means.
Personal one, and then British Brothers as well. I guess that's forum, right?
That's just my political account. I keep a separate personal and political one. So there we are.
Yes. Sounds good. All right, stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll take a short break here, then we'll be back with Adrian Davis. We'll see you on the other side.
The law.
By the way, this show was recorded just a few days before Nigel Farage resigned. Otherwise, we would have talked a bit more about that. We definitely need to follow up on that too, by the way, and see what's going to happen with UKIP in Britain now. If you want to hear more, please stay tuned. We're not done yet. The second hour with Adrian Davis is coming up. It's available for subscribers at redicemembers.com, our members' website. If you're new to the show, you should know that we have over 1,000 radio shows, all Radio 314 shows, videos, insight episodes, and also our new live TV show, Weekend Warrior, that we do on Saturdays. It's all available in the members section. It's only €6 per month, and you can sign up for a 3-month subscription and try it out. If you like it, get a recurring one. If you are a regular listener and want to hear more and haven't signed up yet, please do so. Support what we do and help us grow beyond the live show and the radio shows. We have an incredible amount of material that we would like to do and things we'd like to cover. And as a show that does not have ads or commercial breaks or blinking website banners, we do need your support. So please sign up for a membership with us. Thank you so much. A few of our upcoming guests include Matt Forney, Jay Dyer, Brandon Martinez, and Joshua Blakeney, and also James Bacow, author of Other Losses. But we're not done yet. We're going to return with the second segment right after a break and continue with Adrian Davis. Thank you so much for listening. RedIceMembers.com is the website.